I'd like to welcome everyone this morning. Good morning, everyone. I'd like to welcome you to the second day of our conference. We've been able to bring to you an authentic Virginian day in the summer. I know you all would have been disappointed had you missed it, but these are the glory days of Charlottesville. And we're glad you're here with us. We had a great day of conversations yesterday. Wonderful talk last night by Les Gelb, and we've got a fun and I think very interesting day ahead for us today. We're going to have a session this morning that's going to be followed by a lunch where Bill Kristol's going to give an address. And then in the afternoon we have a very important session for our participants. Where we're going to let go of all the politeness that has been shown around the table, and really go at it on the key issues that are going to drive the volume. So we're looking forward to everyone being there. Our third panel today is being moderated by David Brooks. David is a New York Times columnist, contributing editor at Newsweek and the Wall Street Journal. And a lot of you, of course, have seen him regularly on PBS NewsHour. And David, we're very grateful you're here to help moderate things today. The panel members who prepared papers for it are Francis Fukuyama, a professor of international political economy at Johns Hopkins University, author most recently of America at the Crossroads, Democracy, Power, and the Neoconservative Legacy. Stephen Van Evera is a professor of political science at MIT, and he's the author of the classic Causes of War, Power, and the Roots of Conflict. John Eikenberry is a professor of politics at Princeton and is the author of the prize-winning After Victory, Institutions, Strategic Restraint, and the Rebuilding of Order After Major Wars. Gentlemen, welcome. Look forward to your comments. David?
Thank you. My goal for the next couple hours is to do two things. One, to talk about the future rather than the past. So any mentions of the word Bush will be regarded with suspicion. And any mentions of the word Rumsfeld, neocon, or Bremer will be regarded with outright hostility. The second thing I'm hoping to do is healing the breach between St. Anselm's and UVA. Dean Broder, who I noticed this, cut out on us. Anyway, the dean mentioned St. Anselm's, that he came back for some insane reason. He still goes up to those debates. But he mentioned the two different conversations, the conversations the presidential candidates are having and the conversation we're having. And I'm hoping to bring our conversation a little closer to their conversation. I've given up hope on that one. But I would say I don't think we've quite earned the right to be condescending toward their conversation, because they are in touch with certain things which are true, which haven't always been evident in our conversation, one of which is that there actually will be a president, an actual human being, sitting in the Oval Office over the next 4 years. That human being will have won an election, and that election will have contained certain messages which the human being will have to respond to. And that human being will be a member of a party and will have to represent the views of that party. And before we get on to the more distant future, I did think it was worth anchoring ourselves in the fact that the next president, if I'm going to use the word he, with apologies to Hillary Clinton, if he's a Democrat, well, will inherit certain messages which will be ungetoutable. The first is that we have to get out of Iraq very quickly. The second is that we don't want to have any foreign international interventions anytime in the near future. And the third is that we should do health care first and keep things reasonably quiet on the foreign front so we can do that. I think that'll be the message if a Democrat wins. If a Republican wins, the message will be we've got to take the fight to the terrorists, we've got to do whatever it takes to prevent Iran from getting nukes, and we've got to secure the border with Mexico. And so these are just realities that the next president will have to face, and the next president will have to face also constraints, which Neil and other people have talked about. It's a country now with no self-confidence, where people who think the country's going in the right direction are at historic lows, where faith in institutions is at historic lows, where the current Democratic Congress is as unpopular as the old Republican Congress was, and where people have a sense that whatever we try internationally, we're going to screw it up. And so that crisis of authority will just be a constraint on the administration. And then the second constraint, I think, will be a sense around the world that one sees in the polls and one sees in conversations that people around the world that were not being joined by global media were being divided by it, and many people around the world are really unlike us. And then the third final constraint, the one that really also hampers our discussion, is we don't know whether Iraq will implode or explode over the next few years, and that'll make a big difference. And then that president will sit in the Oval Office, and problems will come at him or her. Iraq, Iran will probably come. I ran into a friend, Ron Osmus, many of you know, who suggested the crucial decision moments in Iran would occur just when the next administration will just be getting started up, will have maybe a third of its positions filled, and suddenly it'll face this Iran mess right away. And so that'll be a problem coming at the president. And then we can all think of the others, global warming, Hugo Chavez, et cetera, et cetera. And so that president will sit there in the Oval Office and look to find a pattern to fit all these different problems coming at him. Children, when they're scared, they look to their mothers, and they look at their mother's expression, and if the mother seems calm, then they become calm, and if the mother seems frightened, then they become frightened. And that president, in looking for his behavioral clues, will look to the wise people in this room, like a needy infant in search of a pattern to explain this all. And so we have a couple papers before us who do sketch out patterns. And I'll quickly, and I feel a little uncomfortable because the people at this end of the table are not exactly amateurs or at explaining their points of view, but my job here is to sort of summarize a little of what they've said, and I apologize if I get it wrong. But I am a professional at this, you should know. First, Stephen has a paper in which the first core point is that we are no longer in a world of competing powers, and I'll read one sentence from the paper. Never in modern times have the world's major powers had less reason to compete with each other or more reason to cooperate to solve problems that commonly threaten them all. So the problems are not competition between states, but the problems are these non-state phenomenon that threaten all the states together. Phenomenon like terrorism, WMDs, global warming, public health problems. And so his goal is to create, or he says the next president should create a system where all the nation states can work together in concert to police these non-nation state actors. And this will involve some preemptive sacrifice, especially on the U.S.'s part, so we can get back in the crowd, so we can create this concert of nations. And we also need to help get over the natural ignorance of the American people about the world. John Eikenberry follows that. I think his paper dovetails and develops a lot of the themes in Stephen's paper, that the two essential things. One is there's no one problem that confronts us the way the Soviet Union organized thinking during the Cold War. Second, that the primary problem is not nation states competing against each other, but it's non-nation state problems. And one of the interesting things about all these papers is they all seem to assume, without really saying it, that the United States is not interested in dominion. We just want to go to Disney World, and we want to be left alone. And we just want to get rid of problems that will interfere with us going to Disney World. And it is we do seem to assume that we're not power interested. Nonetheless, John's five key points are, one, that there's no singular threat. Two, because there's no singular threat, we need to do multitasking, a lot of threats all at once. If it's Tuesday, this must be Al-Qaeda. Three, that we need, like Stephen, we need bold new global structures to take care of all these diffuse problems, where we need tools to take care of these diffuse problems. Four, that the U.S. acting without these global institutions tends to make everything worse. And fifth, and here he develops what these structures would look like, that we need a protective infrastructure, which he calls liberal hegemony. We need to expand the Security Council, create a concert of democracies, and we need to do this quickly before the Chinese get too strong. And so there's really a concert between these two papers, which is the primary problem is not nation states competing with each other, it's these non-nation state problems. Frank is sort of halfway between them, or halfway in their world and halfway out of it. His paper focuses on two big problems. The first is the Middle East, And here he agrees that the main problem is not competition between nation states, but the problem is failed states, these transnational militias, et cetera, et cetera. And his emphasis is on figuring out how to rebuild states and sequencing them to create law and order. And he says we have to use hard power and soft power, and we really shouldn't have a grand theory about pushing democracy in Saudi Arabia. It's probably not a good idea just because of the circumstances there. In Pakistan, it may be a good idea because there actually could be a democratic opposition. So he looks a little like the other two in that he does not emphasize great power competition in the Middle East. But then when he turns to Asia, the other big problem, the problem of China, he's back in the nation-state world. And he says the problem of China is rising. We don't know what the Chinese are going to be like. That's because they don't know what they're going to be like. And here we should build some structures either to around China to sort of limit them or to embed China if they're more amenable to that sort of thing. And so we should have a hedging strategy. And so I think the president, a president who were guided by these three papers, would notice a couple things that all three of them sort of emphasized. First, that the U.S. should be less assertive, should pull back and be part of the international crowd. And so that theme of humility undergirds them all, as so many of the papers. And second, that the problems that these three papers suggest are not primarily the old-fashioned competition between nations, but the competition of the cooperation among nations to tackle social problems. And actually, I should mention, I'll read a sentence from John's paper, which gets right at the core of this. It's useful to think of a strengthened protective infrastructure, which is the global architecture he's talking about, as investment in global social services, much as cities and states invest in social services. It typically is money well spent. Education, health programs, shelters, social services, these are vital components of a stable and well-functioning communities. So it's politics as social services. So the president will see, you know, an emphasis on global cooperation as a way to tackle these social problems, basically, global social problems. But then he may remember a paper he heard about by Bob Kagan, which emphasized that actually nations don't actually cooperate all that much, that we are still in a world of nation-state competition. And he may reflect on his own situation, which is, well, I can't get along with the assholes a mile down Pennsylvania Avenue. Why do I think I'm going to be able to cooperate with people in China and Pakistan? The Chinese strike me as greedy, he might say. The Putin's kind of a jerk. The Saudis are creepy. The Europeans want to make our decisions and then have our boys die for them. You know, I really don't have that much in common with these people. What makes me think that we really could have a concert of nations to tackle these problems? And he may conclude that the papers, and I'll frame it as Eikenberry v. Kagan, he could decide that Eikenberry and Kagan are both right, that Eikenberry is right in describing the problems as these non-nation state problems, but Kagan is right in mentioning that the nations can't get together to solve these problems because they fundamentally do not share the same moral vision, the same cultural understandings. And therefore, he would conclude that we're sort of in a mess of trouble, and that maybe in 1945, the graduates of Eton, Exeter, Sciences Po could get together and create a world order, but that world doesn't exist anymore, and maybe he can't do it. And so what I think he would do is do what the current president is now doing, which is to muddle through the way Condi Rice and Nick Burns are muddling through, and then to think, well, I doubt I can create a global concert, because we just don't share enough to do that. So I'll try to reorient my own government to deal with these non-nation state problems so we can understand them and deal with that. And I think that's sort of the central tension that these papers represent, is I think there's a common agreement on the non-state problems that are out there, but I personally was unpersuaded that states can realistically cooperate to address them, which is the thing, the doubt that's raised by the paper Bob mentioned yesterday. And so my first question to the three people here, given what's happening, our inability to impose an embargo on Iran, our inability in Darfur, various other failures, what makes us realistically think we can actually create a global concert that will be effective? I'm going to go to Stephen.
My short answer would be Point one, in the past, in the 20th century, we successfully organized two vast coalitions and held them together for a long time and got them to pay a big price for victory and brought them to victory. In World War II, we had, if you total up the total GNP of the Grand Alliance, it was more than half the world's. It was very diverse. You used a technical term earlier, assholes, I believe. That's a technical term. We shouldn't say those things at the University of Virginia because everyone has a necktie on. But it included Joe Stalin, who was a world-class member of that community to which you referred. Joseph Broz Tito, who also was, Chiang Kai-shek, the Vichy government. It was a very broad alliance full of horrible people who had no common values with us. They had a single common interest, which was to defeat the Nazis and the Japanese. And we did it again in the Cold War. And I might add, this was a very successful policy because we shed all the costs of the war onto the Allies. Americans think we won World War II. I'm sorry to tell you, we didn't. Okay, the Allies did. They paid 96% of the cost of that war's victory was paid by Allies. So we've done it before. That's answer number one. Answer number two is we have a common interest in doing it. You were sort of saying, well, these other countries, you know, they're led by jerks and so forth. Absolutely. If you believe that people in the end act in their interests, my argument is they have an interest with us in solving these global problems. The terrorists are going to get them, too. Putin is under terror threat. First of all, I believe the whole world economy will suffer greatly if any major industrial state suffers a big terror attack. We were arguing about that over dinner with Neil Ferguson, and it's a great question. How bad will the effects be if we have a WMD attack in New York or London or Washington? But I think the whole world will catch the disease, so the whole world has an interest in dampening the problem. And we have a common interest in solving these other what people call commons problems, which cannot be solved individually. The climate problem, if you believe it's serious, I think it's extremely serious, cannot be solved by a unitary action, just as no so-called collective action problem can be solved by the single action of anyone. The economists will all tell you about externalities and how you can't solve a problem where externalities are the problem without common action. And now, you're pessimistic about whether we can organize this, and in my paper I talked about all the impediments to organizing a broad concert of action. I think there's domestic forces in the U.S. that won't like it. I think that the U.S. defense establishment won't like it. I think that the Polish lobby won't like it because they don't want to cooperate with the Russians, and the Taiwan lobby won't like it because they won't want to have good relations with China. The American people, I don't think, are mentally prepared for this in the sense that they don't, as I was saying yesterday, we have an insular culture that doesn't know much history, and the whole basis for this policy, I think, is grounded in history. So I'm not saying this is easy. Frankly, I think we're not going to do it. But I think the job of academics is to plant the flag, point the way, and tell the policy world, here's what we think is wise, and let the public and the policy world either buy the argument or not.
Oh, it's a great question, and it is it's an underlying problem that is our scholarly agenda in international relations, explain conflict and cooperation, and it's you get both, and you never get entirely a system of harmony that's not to be expected. But my response would be to you or to our candidate or president is that the U.S. has a huge capacity and record of cooperation, and it's been hugely beneficial to the United States. The global system itself is more, I don't know how you measure levels of cooperation. That'd be an interesting question across eras. What era do you find the most manifested cooperation? I would say, whatever your metric, probably today, that is to say, in the post-war era and in the post-Cold War era, you get more cooperation measured in terms of agreements and treaties and institutions and just sheer movement of people, goods, ideas, the kind of support of an open system. We have a massively a complex global system built on some rudimentary level of cooperation, and so we're building on something, not simply making some existential question: should we cooperate or not? We are sitting on top of a system that's based on huge amounts of cooperation, including American. Secondly, we are in an era where there is more congruence on vision than ever before. This is the dirty little secret: we don't have great ideological differences with the other major states. There is no competing universal ideology out there. China doesn't have it. Russia doesn't have it. Chavez doesn't have it. And the United States and Europe share a common vision more than they don't. I don't think that would be a poor excuse for not buying onto an agenda. And then thirdly, interests themselves, as Steve says. I mean, that's the underlying question. Is there a convergence of interests? There are still questions of collective action problems, shirking, free riding. So even if you get common interests, it doesn't mean you get cooperation, but it's essential to have the interests there. And in an era of globalization, the costs of not cooperating go up relative to the costs of lost autonomy associated with making binding commitments. So the U.S. and the other countries lose more as time goes on if globalization intensifies relative to the loss of sovereignty or whatever pinches in terms of binding commitments. And then finally, I would just say on the security side, we look out into the future, and my paper suggests that we have multiple threats in front of us, and therefore we should create mechanisms to deal with come what may, and there are lots of different problems, and 20 years from now they may be different problems than today, and we should have the capacities and infrastructure to deal with them. But if you take the sort of super empowered individual or the terrorist group that with WMD, if that is the singular problem, I'm not saying it is, but it's clearly one of them, of the great problems. What kind of world will we need to have in 2050 or 2075 or the end of this century to deal with this? If the K ratio, that is to say, we know from history that over time it takes fewer and fewer people with a different and more violence capacity to kill more people. So if fewer people equipped with technology to kill more people, the K ratio is shifting against us so that in 2050, 2075, we can hypothesize fairly easily that there will be individuals out there who are not states who can attack cities and more than cities. What kind of world do we need to have in place to deal with that? And it seems to me we're going to need very complex systems of cooperation. Monitoring, enforcement, inspections, the IAEA on steroids. We're going to need to be engaged in sophisticated forms of cooperative security with most of the states. And I would say, back to interest, the interest will be there to do that. But it's going to require the U.S. Building on its enlightened blend of liberalism and realism to think about how it projects itself and uses its power to create these structures that address real interests.
Well, I didn't argue that we needed a grand concert, so I don't have to defend that position, and I actually think that it's not going to work. And part of the reason it's not going to work is, again, I think it's a projection forward of a kind of 19th century view of what international relations is and the degree to which great powers can actually affect outcomes in these very unstable parts of the world. So I'm actually kind of at a loss. Even if Russia, China, and the United States agreed on this grand concert against terrorism, what concretely would that mean other than we would give the Russians a free hand in Chechnya? Because, first of all, the actual cooperation, going after an al-Qaeda guy that's transiting through Central Asia, that exists already. I mean, you don't need a grand concert to do that. But the real places where it matters, Iraq, Afghanistan, other parts of the Middle East, Russia and China are not going to help you on this. And I think, in general, I've come to the conclusion that the world is actually, in John's terms, under-institutionalized in terms of various forms of international cooperation. But I guess my vision of where you need to go is you really need a much more complex and less ambitious set of overlapping institutions to deal with specific functional and regional problems. And a lot of them are not going to be ones that are designed in Washington, you know, in the way we did in after 1945, because I just don't think that the world is that pliable. But I do think you've got to take existing systems that are out there and figure out how you're going to work with them. So that's why in the paper I went through, I mean, it's fair amount of detail on Asia, but Asia's got a lot of multilateral organizations, and I think the actual concrete decisions that will face American policymakers in 2009 in dealing, for example, with a question of China is, do you build regional organizations that include or exclude China? I mean, that's the concrete way that this is going to manifest itself. The Japanese, for example, are working with half of our government, more conservative half of our government, are reviving hub and spoke based on Washington, a whole set of bilateral agreements. Everybody that's got a beef with China, you know, India, Mongolia, Japan, Australia, you know, they want to link then all the parts of all the ends of those spokes into a kind of honeycomb sort of thing. That's one vision for what Asia could look like in another 5 years. And another one is to actually try to reinvigorate something like ASEAN plus three as a means of reintegrating Japan back into a more Asian concert. And, you know, we've been so distracted by the Middle East that I don't think we actually have an opinion on which of these we want. We've kind of been pursuing, you know, all of them simultaneously. But I think realistically, if you talk about the choices that are going to be in front of policymakers, it's actually working with a lot of the stuff that exists already. By the way, I just wanted to make one point about, you know, we had this discussion. A lot of this will be driven by America's relative power position, because if you're King Kong, you don't feel like you need to cooperate. Why be tied down by Lilliputians and so forth? And so it's a very important empirical fact how quickly American relative power is going to shift. Steve, in his paper, said that China reaching parity with the United States is decades away, and I think that that is not right, because I actually looked this up on the World Bank website this morning. In current dollars, in nominal dollars, China's GDP is about $2.2 trillion. Ours is about 12.4, so it's one-sixth. But in PPP terms, China's GDP is the second largest in the world. We are at 12.4, and they are at 8.8. Japan is only 3.9, then Germany, you know, everybody else ranks lower. Now, PPP has got, there are a lot of problems with using that as a measure of real wealth, but I think this assumption that, you know, we've got several decades until China catches up is you know, not right. It's going to happen a lot sooner, and so therefore the, you know, the need to think through what you deal, you know, what do you want this, I mean, it's a question John raised yesterday, is what do you want a world, you know, you're not going to be able to stop this juggernaut or derail it in any fundamental way, and so you have to think ahead to, you know, what's the world, and I would say, you know, 10 years down the road that you're going to want to see in terms of, you know, different kinds of international structures that will deal with one in which our relative power is lower.
Do either of you have a problem with these problem-specific institutions, with maybe without a secretariat? Why think of a grand global concert when Frank says, you know, more specific, more practical institutions?
I agree. I think Frank's term multilateralism is apt. I think that's ultimately what the Princeton Project report that I co-authored argues for. It's problem-driven. But we should, I think, where I might just add a little bit, and this is where Jim Kurth's paper, I would comment on it as well. There needs to be some encompassing institutions that do provide legitimacy for universal standards, and I think the UN can play a role, so I think we should not give up on reform, and it's a vehicle for bringing new countries into the global system and give them a seat at the table. That's in American interest, in part of this investment strategy for the future. So I think some of these institutions, they may not have real functional roles, but legitimating roles. I've argued, some of us around the table have argued for a concert of democracy, for also to kind of squeeze more cooperation out of countries that we know do share values and have capacities to cooperate. They don't always do it, but I wouldn't give up on that. But I think Frank's right that you build up, but you also have a vision of the overall architecture, and so I think you have to talk about how would you like the overall order to be organized. So order talk, I think, is necessary.
No invited to make special comments on John's paper?
I have, but was it my turn? Okay. I can comment on John's paper. We can sort of just talk this. In fact, John and I already had our conversation at breakfast this morning, so we've settled all of our issues.
He's withdrawn all his objections.
Right. John explained it all to me. But, first of all, a simple point. It's possible for nations to have common interests and divergent interests at the same time. I mean, I think, all the great powers of Europe and the United States were having their top leaders assassinated by the anarchist movement at the end of the 19th century and the early part of the 20th century, and had a common interest in preventing that, and then had no difficulty going into World War I. And I think, I think Frank is right that Russia's idea of its common interest in stamping out terrorism is being played out in Chechnya. China's will be played out against its minority populations. The idea, and they will cooperate, as he says, and already do. But I think I just think it's optimistic to believe that we are not, in fact, and this is, my biggest criticism of John's paper is the dismissal of the possibility that we are, in fact, back at some level of sort of classic international competition. I think we may be led to ignore this by the fact that because the United States, it is sort of a unipolar world still, but beneath that, there really is, Russia shows every classic sign of being a typical kind of ambitious, resentful, it's heavily driven by nationalism. Most of its actions today can be explained not by any particular response to security threats, but by sort of classically Russian ambition / resentments. China clearly has, they're not just economic maximizers, they're also honor maximizers, they're also ambitious for where they, and it's totally natural that they should be. And this, this raises problems, certainly for a concert of nations, which includes these. And there is the ideological problem. I mean, the classic 19th century concert of nations, which, by the way, was a much briefer period than people imagine, was a response to, Napoleon and the French Revolution, and they had a common, not only a common set of interests in preventing war, but a common set of interests in preserving a kind of monarchic, aristocratic order against liberal revolution. And as Britain became more liberal over the course of the next couple of decades, that kind of began to fall apart. I think it's wrong to say just because China doesn't have an exportable ideology that it doesn't have a different ideology. And it's going to be hard to have a concert of nations where not only do you have competitive national behavior, but you also have genuine ideological disagreements. And like in John's paper, he calls for an American-led hegemonic order with liberal characteristics, which I almost read as American hegemonic order with Chinese characteristics. You know how they have the high-tech war with Chinese characteristics? If you went to Beijing and sat down with your counterpart in Beijing and said, so here's my goal, it's an American-led hegemonic order with liberal characteristics, I don't think they would say, where do I sign up? And that's true in Moscow for sure.
The WTO is part of that. They do sign up.
No, they're with you on the WTO.
Well, that's part of the system.
But that's because it's not, I don't think you would describe the American, the WTO as an American hegemonic order. Okay, they want to be in a WTO, but they don't want to be in a geopolitical, geostrategic, American-dominated hegemonic order. Do they? Well, anyway, you don't have to answer that question. I know what their response to that would be, and so do you. You know what their response to that would be. In fact, if you read Chinese strategic writings, and there have been some very good compilations of this by David Shambaugh and others, it is precisely American liberal hegemonism that they have been complaining about since at least the mid 1990s, and that was their big lesson from Kosovo. That was the ultimate expression of American-led hegemonic order. I know I'm going to go on too long.
No, keep going.
There is a tension, as we discussed, between an order designed to preserve the American position and a liberal international order, the thesis of which is that everybody is kind of an equal. And that's a tension that's not so easy to resolve, and others see it as a greater tension even than we do. Now, there's also, and there's a tension between what you call for, which is strengthening alliances. But these alliances have purposes, and they have opponents. And I think, in fact, we are going to strengthen alliances. Because of the rise of China, because of increasing concern about Russia, we're going to have stronger alliance structures in Asia, the kind that Frank talked about. And we're going to have a stronger relationship with Europe over time, especially Eastern Europe, which is now Europe and the Balts. But these are not going to improve our relationships with China and Russia. I mean, in an earlier paper you once wrote, you talked about how everything was great because we had NATO enlargement, we had a good relationship with Russia, and it was, I stopped, wait a second. NATO enlargement helped destroy our relationship with Russia. And so there's a contradiction between these alliance structures that you want to build up and a global concert because, they are inherently divisive. I will stop there.
Well, lots of important issues here, and I appreciate these comments. They're tough ones. I think on this, Bob has argued yesterday and today again, and it's not just in some sense an implicit critique of my paper, but also of Steve's and maybe Frank's as well, that this kind of the return to great power politics. And I just, as I said yesterday, I don't think it's quite a return. Clearly, I think about the world in terms of great powers, so I'm with you in terms of thinking about power states and power and distributions and strategic behavior, and I think it's not going to go away, and nothing in the kind of liberal vision I suggest extinguishes it. But the other point about it is, which modifies your position, is that, as I said yesterday, it's not a return to a kind of 19th century system where great power war is on the table because of nuclear weapons and because of the integration, really, of this Western system into something that is more than states, the OECD world. The fact that most of those wealthy great powers are democracies and highly integrated with each other. So, yes, Russia and China are not in it. They are ambivalent about it. They're partially in it. And I would say if we play our cards right, we might get them more in it than not. And we can wash out over the long term because of the imperatives of modernization and how you functionally gear your system so that you can generate wealth and growth and modernity, that they are likely to choose to be more in it than out of it. And because of the fact that war isn't on the table even with them, because they feel deterred and we feel deterred, it's going to be a kind of odd system that the history doesn't provide us really models of. Yes, it's competition. Yes, it's great powers, but it's not. It's great power politics within security communities and within bounded realms of insecurity. Second point, just a little bit more about China. I don't think you should give up on China making choices to be inside of this system. As I said, I think this. And this is relevant to Frank's point about China growing faster than we think and passing the U.S. maybe sooner than we think. But China is not just facing the United States, it's facing the OECD world. And when you look at those figures, China has more decades before it could really be a system challenger to the American-led, yes, or Western-led system, which in PPP terms is three or four times what it would be if you just counted America alone. So China, when looking up, what does China face? It faces not just the United States as earlier great powers that have risen up have faced, Germany facing Britain, and before that Napoleon and the others were facing states. China faces a system, highly institutionalized and integrated, and as I said, it's harder to overturn, it's easier to join. They're already in it, WTO, Security Council. So I think we have the tools and we have the system on our side to make the power transition with China one that is not entirely unfavorable to us. So let's use this system. Let's don't throw it away. And that's why my paper is saying keep an eye on the architecture because that is our big long-term asset. And then alliances, I'll stop, but I'll come back to alliances. I think that's an important issue.
Can I on this point, there's something that connects you two, which is you both agree, and I think all the participants do, on the need for a concert of democracies or some association of democracies. Indeed, the administration does. This should be the easiest institution to build. Why has this institution not been built, and what can the next president do to do it?
Well, I don't think we're all in agreement on that at all. I mean, the Concert of Democracies, which I do think is a good idea, is inherently divisive because of who it's not going to include. And it's much more like the East Asian Security Order, where Japan and Australia and the United States and India are in it and China isn't, and that's going to create, you know. And if you go to Europe, which, by the way, I forgot to mention, if you say American-led hegemonic order in Paris, I think you get an even worse response than you do in Beijing.
What we say in this room stays in this room. We use different words for different social occasions.
But, you know, even in Paris, a concert of democracies does not go over well because, A, they see it as an effort to create an American-led hegemonic order, and, B, they see it as something transplanting the United Nations, which they, at this point, especially for if you're France, you value the United Nations Security Council. But anyway, maybe there are other views.
Well, yeah, my assignment is to comment on Steve Van Ever's paper, which contains many things that I think virtually everyone around this table could agree to, despite the differences in our premises and orientations, the need for anti-nuclear proliferation measures, the need for better intelligence capacity, the need for a military reconfigured for asymmetric warfare, the need for better public diplomacy, better international education, better state-building capacity, policies that don't impair the United States' capacity to lead, and refreshing America's membership in an array of multilateral institutions. Maybe that one's a little more divisive amongst us, but I think by and large there's a lot to agree with here. But I would just like to raise three questions about Steve's paper, some of which will echo things that have already been said. First, is it logically consistent to posit that nuclear weapons have, the possession of nuclear weapons has, and nuclear deterrence has stabilized great power relationships, a good thing, and then to argue that nuclear proliferation is the greatest threat to stability in the world today? At least on the face of it, there seems to be a kind of a logical disconnect there. Secondly, a second question, does it follow that stabilization of great power relationships through the mechanism of nuclear deterrence is a sufficient condition for great power cooperation? It seems to me there's one glaring historical example that argues precisely the contrary, which is the history of the Cold War, where there was nuclear deterrence to the United States and the Soviet Union, proved a mighty weak basis for cooperation or collaboration between those two powers. Third question, leaving aside the oddity of invoking the Concert of Europe as a model for a 21st century liberal democratic state to emulate as the template of its own grand strategy, and this I think echoes David Brooks' questions and others, is there really a usable concert of purpose in the world community today? And I would offer the example of two states that in Steve's paper, if you accept the premises of it, there is little or no probability of their confronting one another, China and the United States, because of the nuclear deterrence and so on. But look at the one very specific and concrete issue in which those two states have been involved recently, which is North Korea nuclear weapons. And the great difficulty they've had in cooperating, though we might posit that they have a common interest in nonproliferation. In fact, the valence of that issue is different with respect to the two different states. China is much more worried about the disintegration of the North Korean regime and millions of refugees coming across its border. It's more worried about that than it is about the immediate threat of nuclear attack. So, as I say, the stability that nuclear deterrence introduces, it seems to me, is not a sufficient condition for guaranteeing cooperation.
Stephen, do you want to?
Well, those are great questions. Point one, are nuclear weapons the problem or the solution? And I agree with David, of course, that there's an irony here. I'm arguing that they're the solution to the security problem between great powers, and they are the danger when in the hands of non-deterrible actors that we all face in the shape of terror. They're Janus-faced. To mean the nuclear revolution, what has it done to the world? What's the implication for us all that we invented these powerful instruments of destruction? And the answer is that it's indeterminate. It depends on who has them. If the actor who has the weapons is deterrable, meaning are they rational? Are they sensitive to costs in their behavior? Do they perceive the world accurately? Then nuclear weapons are manna from heaven in a strange way. My argument would be most warfare down through the last 2,000 years was about national security. If you ask why have most countries gone to war and what was the driving motive most of the time, it was the security dilemma. How do I make myself safe? I'm not safe if you're around me and strong and threatening me. Once both sides have secure deterrence, conquest is out of the question. The problem of national conquest is off the table. And so this thing that's driven war through the ages is essentially solved. And you raise the Cold War as an example, and that's a great question, and I think it's very interesting to ask, well, so fine, why didn't nuclear weapons stop the Cold War? And to some extent, I believe in the end it did. The Gorbachev elite, if you go to the New Thinkers and ask, what were they thinking in the 80s? A number of them had an epiphany about international politics. If you go back and read what some of the folks at ISKCON and Andrei Kortunov and others were saying, they were saying, why do we need an empire in Eastern Europe? A nuclear deterrence means we're secure even if the Allies are on our borders because they can't invade us. We're engaging in old think here in believing that we need to control Czechoslovakia, East Germany, and so on. They argued this, and this was the basis for their case to Gorbachev, that they should end the Cold War by pulling out of Eastern Europe. And by the way, that's what they did. The Soviet Union did not collapse. That's not how the Cold War ended. It ended with a Soviet withdrawal from Eastern Europe. So I think nuclear weapons are Janus faced, immensely dangerous in the hands of non-deterrable actors, immensely, and pacifying in the hands of deterrable actors. So that's a point we should debate, and I think has been underappreciated in general discourse about world politics, and part of the fault is academics. Academics never kind of wrote this up or explained it. Okay, I'll stop with that.
Bill?
Struck by Steve saying that the most, his reading of 2,000 years of history is that most warfare is due to national security or fears about national security. Obviously, if that's defined loosely and broadly enough, it becomes tautological. I would say if it's defined in any real way, it's manifestly false. Most major warfare for 2,000 years has had nothing to do with a prosaic concern to defend one's borders or a serious notion that one is about to be overrun. Most huge wars over 2,000 years have had to do with religion, ideology, Napoleon, Hitler, people who had grand conquests, honor, and the like. I'm happy to defend this and debate this, but I think it'd be very hard to explain the massive wars of the religious wars from, let's say, 670 through 1650 or something like that as being classic national security wars. It'd be hard to explain Napoleon as really concerned that France was about to be conquered, hard to explain Hitler by a concern that Germany was about to be overrun, et cetera, et cetera. Now, lots of prosaic wars happen. They tend to be much smaller. They tend to be border wars, and they tend to be either result in the conquest of one country or another or a truce, a la, I don't know, Israel-Arab wars, let's say. Though even those can't really be explained by national security, since presumably the Arab states don't feel truly endangered by the existence of Israel. So I think there is a tendency, therefore, in these 21st century concert of nations type theories to wildly underestimate the importance of ideology, religion, honor, pride, and other such factors in human history. Secondly, and this gets to the sort of Jeff's question about, well, why can't we all at least agree on a concert of democracies? I mean, we have concerts of democracies. We shouldn't mistake sort of, again, form for other forms. I mean, NATO, of course, is a concert of democracies. We have a de facto democratic alliance in East Asia with Japan and India now. I'd say some of us have argued that it should be made a little more formal and the like. But I'm not against having a broader one. But that is totally different from saying multilateral institutions without regard to the nature of the regime, which is what the WTO is, and which is what the UN Security Council is, and which, of course, is in tension with the notion of a Council of Democracies. Now, I'm on the democratic side of this debate, but one can make a responsible debate that, look, world security is very important. You don't get to immediately transform regimes, and we've got to be grown up, and we have to have a concert of serious nations, which would include China and Russia, and would include working, as people argued last night, with Iran, even as they take hostages and all that, because come on, we've got to be grown-ups. But you can't have both. I mean, you can have both to some degree, and of course that's what real statesmen or real politicians do, is try to balance some desire to promote democracy with some need to work with the world the way the world is. But to simply throw out, well, I'm for multilateralism, without explaining whether it is multilateralism of the let's accommodate China and not say too much about Tibet, and let's accommodate Iran and not say too much about what they're doing, and let's accommodate Putin and let's say too much about what he's doing, because that's grown-up multilateralism, or to go in the concert of democracies point, that's a real debate. But you can't just say, well, I guess everyone at the table is for multilateralism, and leave it at that.
There seems to be a foundational difference on how deep the, or profound the ideological, moral, and splits are between one side and the other. That goes back to the Cold War. Charles?
Well, I just put up two hands originally to respond. I think Bill is wrong about his view of history and wars. I think even when ideology is at stake, even when overweening ambition or megalomania is at stake, countries, World War I, of course, is the major exception to yours, but even the wars of religion, these arise out of the concern for the balance of power between Protestant and religion and Catholic states. There's the constant calculation that we are on the way down, this constant feeling of mutual vulnerability and a resulted temptation for preemption or for quick responsiveness. And so this is a way of reading. I mean, each of the conflicts you propose to look at ideology, I would say, well, the actual war arises from the security dilemma. Now, that doesn't help very much. I'm less sanguine than Steve about nuclear weapons. I use the analogy, you know, for 40 years we crossed a frozen lake. We had no idea whether the ice was very thick and we could go across easily, like the Russians did at Lake Ladoga when Leningrad was at sea, or whether the ice was very thin and we were just went through by the skin of our teeth. And I don't think we can resolve that debate because the counterfactual didn't occur. But I think these are not God's gift, I don't think. And I think they are very dangerous, and I can see them being unleashed. Forces get out of control. Our game theorist, Tom Schelling, gave a very interesting speech at Harvard. I may have published it a few months ago, in which he said the real achievement was that in the nuclear regime, was that no country, even when they're convinced there's no retaliation possible, has thought to use these weapons since August 9th, 1945, or is really they've thought to, but has. I mean, there's a type of restraint there. Well, it would be nice if we could get to that. I hear two major contradictions around the table, or there's more than two. Bob Kagan essentially says the United States has a special position which makes its diplomacy troublesome because we're revolutionary, have revolutionary origins, and that still is important to have. But at the same time, we're a deeply conservative power. And Johns, I think you're right, the vulnerability is you cannot say, hey, we're going to be hegemonic, and gee, we want you to be, you know, happy about this multilateralism. That doesn't mean we have to renounce, but it's just going to lead, we're going to just be doomed to these tensions, I think. And rather than look at grand strategy, and this is my concern about this conference, I think what we really need are people with good sensitivity at every particular step of the way who will respond with some tact but concern for our interests. I don't think this is I'm not sure strategy, doctrine, will get us anywhere in the world in terms of survival and interests over the next century.
I want to go to Neil and then ask Barry to respond to Frank.
You may remember David saying you didn't want to talk about the past. We've done nothing else.
No, he didn't talk about Bush.
Oh, the recent the past. Recent. Well, as we're talking about the deep past here, let me offer a couple of thoughts prompted by the three papers. First, Steve's, I was fascinated by a parallel drawn with the Bismarckian precedent. I mean, this paper is full of riches, but one of the most interesting ones is the point made towards the end when he says that the United States needs to play a Bismarckian strategy of trying to prevent conflict between the major powers by somehow balancing them against one another. This notion of a sort of, 19th century concert, which is central to Steve's argument, strikes me as raising some problems about what the 19th century was really like. The 19th century was not a time of peace. There were constant wars. There was a war in every year of Queen Victoria's reign. And this goes to Bill's point. What were these wars about? Basically, there were wars between empires. 82% of the world's population at the end of the 19th century lived in some kind of empire or another. And yet we sit around talking as if the world of the 19th century was regulated by nation states. It wasn't. Nation-states were sort of invented in the late 19th century with the creation of Italy, which was in fact a Piedmontese empire, and Germany, which was in fact a Prussian empire. So I think we have a problem with our whole model of what the 19th century was like. And it also saw big wars between the empires. What was Crimea? We seem to have forgotten that that happened. What was the Franco-Prussian War? That was a big war too. They were relatively short, but they were still quite serious conflicts. So I think we have to be careful in drawing what I think are somewhat stereotyped or facile parallels with the 19th century. I don't think they bear any relation to its historical reality. Then we get to San Francisco as opposed to Vienna. I'm sticking to these labels because they work for me. Can we somehow resurrect a liberal hegemonic order, which is really John's question? And it gets to the issue of what this concept of democracies could be like, or whether it already in some measure exists. A couple of points. One, NATO wasn't a concept of democracies when it was started. It became one. There's another model out there which hasn't been mentioned, the Commonwealth. Perhaps the United States might like to join the Commonwealth and put aside some unfortunate historic differences that arose even before the 19th century. Second question, I mean, I'd really love to know what this concept of democracies is going to be like, who gets to join, and what are the criteria for membership? Let's just talk a little bit about that, because that at least is forward-looking and we don't debate the past. But there's a problem with creating this concept of democracies. It's a bit like the G7 meeting, or G8 as one of the new boys in the block has been asked to join. Will these powers really matter 20 years down the line? And this goes to Frank's point. When does China actually overtake the United States? Well, the people at Goldman recalculated their projections recently. The date they now have is 2027. That is when, according to their projections, China's GDP, and that's not based on purchasing power parity, which is a meaningless concept, based on actual dollar values. That is the year when China takes over.
Why is
coalition?
Can I ask either of you why? What happens when those lines cross?
Only an American could ask the question.
No. If you're talking about a vast GDP because you have a billion and a half people and they're it's like $3,000 a head as opposed to $40,000 a head. Isn't there a difference between those two GDPs?
Not in terms of the amount of weaponry you can buy. They've increased their defense budget by 300% in the space of a
decade. Then talk about defense budgets.
Because by all means.
That's a choice.
Yesterday you talked about our defense budget versus the insurgent defense budget.
Well, our defense budget is, in a sense, constrained politically, but China's isn't because it's not a democracy. It can spend as much as it likes on creating a Pacific nuclear fleet, which is what it's doing at the moment.
Is that 2027 date based on continued 8.5% or 9.5% growth?
Actually, no, they're quite conservative estimates for China's growth. They could be. I can give you it if you give me literally 2 minutes.
Then another question. If that were to happen in 2027...
And by the way, that also includes quite optimistic projections for U.S. growth.
Has there been that kind of steady growth by any great power in history before? If in 2027 we see what they're projecting... Hmm. Will that stretch of uninterrupted growth without crisis, without fallback, be unprecedented? Or is this sort of something that we would expect a great power like China to do? Does this require kind of heroic views about history isn't working the way it used to because we've got China growing at this rate and without
It has happened before. It's called the history of the United States. Mm-hmm. We used to, you know, run the world and regard the colonies that we'd lost in North America as of marginal importance. That's 1815, the concept of Europe, the world of Vienna. The United States, total irrelevance in world power. 100 years later, dominant in terms of economy. And then another 50 years later, totally dominant in terms of geopolitics. That's the precedent. And China is essentially to the United States today what the United States was to Britain as it caught up with it about 100 years ago and suddenly overtook it.
Say that again.
Did you say 100 years?
100 years for what time frame?
Just 30 years of 8% growth.
The one footnote to Neil, I don't think accept this precedent, but if you want to use that analogy, if China in fact becomes a liberal democracy, if political liberalization follows economic liberalization, it will be as unproblematic as the United States replacing Britain as the liberal hegemonic power was. So regimes matter most.
Why should China behave like the United States in political terms?
Well, it would
depend
on the kind of regime.
The United States started out when it was a small breakaway insurgency movement as democratic. That is not in China's cultural makeup.
Well, I mean, I'm saying is it frames the issue of what the nature of. I mean, it is not a bad thing from the world historical point of view that a billion Chinese are escaping famine and poverty and becoming able to live decent lives. A huge amount, therefore, depends on what kind of regime they live in, and we can then debate practically what would be most, whether what combination of engagement and pressure would help create a decent regime. But, I mean, we are talking a little bit as if it's, you know, a priori terrible that China is going to become very wealthy, which, in fact, is not a bad thing.
I wasn't implying that it's terrible, no, but it's a fact. It means a concept of democracies will become less and less important, at least in terms of economic.
Unless China is a democracy.
Right, well.
Well, I mean, I don't know. India is a democracy. India is a huge Asian nation, so.
Yeah.
I once interviewed Jeff Immelt, the GE CEO, and I asked him, if you were betting 20 years out, who would you bet on, China or India? And he said, oh, that's easy. For the next 10 years, China. After that, India. And I've asked that question to many executives, and they all agree. So it could be that we're worrying not so much about what happens when China has 8% growth. We could be worrying 10 years out what happens when China has 0% growth, which the problems will be much worse. But why don't we, instead of me BSing, turn to a real economist, Barry.
I didn't have a chance yesterday to thank the organizers for the invitation and the conference on what will surely be the fourth most important issue in the presidential election next year. After environment, immigration, and healthcare, if you don't believe me, come visit us in California. We're an early primary state.
Gallup poll today shows Iraq dominated the presidential race.
We'll see.
You can't really complain, with all due respect, that the last couple of elections, the voters aren't paying attention to foreign policy or the war. Both the 2004 and 2006 elections turned on them.
All right, I've got your attention. Let me let me talk a little bit about Frank's paper, which I think is eminently sensible, by which I mean I don't see much with which I disagree. I think it gets the balance between traditional security threats and postmodern security threats right. I disagreed with some of the discussion yesterday about how if terrorist events are low probability, we shouldn't invest too much in their prevention, as I think I'm one of the two people at this table who probably pays the most for earthquake insurance. A low probability event, but something that some of us feel compelled to devote a substantial share of our incomes to protecting against. And I think about the non-traditional security threats in very much the same way. The paper, however, uses classic battlefield language and I think to some extent classic battlefield logic to think about those threats and to talk about Iraq as well, which I don't find terribly helpful. It talks about victory and defeat. It has sentences like we cannot emerge victorious, but neither can we be defeated, without, as far as I could tell, defining victory and defeat in this context. So it's important to define them. The academic point, I guess I think of victory in this context as facilitating the acquisition of a monopoly of force by a legitimate Iraqi government. And from that point of view, I think if I'm allowed to define the concept, then I agree with the statement that that we can't emerge victorious. This is not something, by the way, I've defined the problem that I think an outside power can achieve, lacking legitimacy in a different national context. Defeat in this context, I suppose, means unilateral disorderly withdrawal. And from that point of view, it does seem to me that we can be defeated. So if the author disagrees, he should tell us more, I think, about what his definition of the terms entails. I thought the discussion in the paper of democratization and its connection with the larger issues was most interesting. And again, I agreed with much of it. I agree that no U.S. administration can fail to encourage democratic values internationally. The question is how. I thought the discussion of the sequencing problem essentially got the issues right. And I guess I should clarify what I meant about that, because I learned at dinner last night that I may have something I said about that yesterday may have been misunderstood to an extent. My statement was about whether democracy has a causal link running to economic development. And there I think one can say unequivocally that the empirical literature on that answer is decisively no, that both democracies and non-democracies can be good at economic development. They can be bad at economic development, and it depends on many things. I think there are other reasons why we value democracy, and we should encourage its spread around the world. But the idea that it bears some causal connection to subsequent economic development, especially in poor countries, is simply not supported by the data. That's quite separate from the issue of the reverse causal connection running from economic development to subsequent political development and liberalization. And there I think the data are pretty clear that modernization theory has, in that sense, has stood the test of time. The paper then takes a sharp turn to China and to the issues that we've been discussing for the last few minutes. So I would make a couple of points about that. When will China overtake the United States? How much should we care? The first point is that we should not talk in purchasing power parity terms here at all. The price of haircuts in China, which are the kind of things that make PPP numbers differ from market numbers, doesn't much affect their ability to project force internationally or shape the course of international relations. So it's market exchange rates. A second point would be Goldman Sachs doesn't always get it right. And when I do the compound interest, I see China overtaking the U.S. in aggregate terms, projecting current growth rates out. Now, there's a big assumption. In 3 decades from now, 2037, not 15 years. Even if you believe current growth rates, the current growth differential between China and the U.S. will continue, which is implausible. Even if you believe that China will not decelerate between now and then, it'll take 3 decades by the iron laws of compound interest. It is still an issue, and that's where I think Frank raises the right issues, but he doesn't dispose of any of them. So I don't quite see any of the models that your rhetoric suggests you find relatively appealing, the honeycomb model, as viable. The Asian neighbors want China in rather than out of any security relationship in the region. More and more, I think, contrary to what I've heard at the table, when I talk to people in Asia, they want the U.S. out rather than in. I think the ASEAN plus 3 model is the most promising, but any significant progress on that model is many decades down the road.
No, that's a good summary of what I said. I think that, well, I'm not going to talk about the Iraq stuff because, when I was saying that we can't be defeated, just meant if we keep up 160,000 troops and several, tens of billions of dollars a year, we can stay as long as we want. And I don't think that's going to happen. But if you grant that, then we can't be. On the question, again, to bring this all back to something more concrete that actually a president will have to deal with in the next administration, when you talk about liberal hegemony and American influence, the way the rubber is going to hit the road in very concrete terms in the short run are going to be things like voting shares, in the Bretton Woods institutions, in the World Bank, and the IMF, given the rise of Asia and other powerful countries. And I think Fareed was quite right yesterday when he said that in the 1990s, the IMF particularly, in a way operated as an extension of the U.S. Treasury Department in terms of the kinds of policies. And it's been the anchor for market-friendly thinking about the global economy for the last generation. It's very important in that sense in terms of ideas. And so I think when you think about eroding hegemony, I don't think about it in military terms. I actually think about it in terms of what kinds of ideas about development are going to be projected by international institutions, and are we going to be ceding influence in this, I think, rather important area to some of these rising powers over the next few years. And that's why a lot of these debates over governance at these multilateral institutions, most people's eyes glaze over, but it actually has an important down-the-road effect on what kinds of economic ideas are going to be dominant when in the coming generation. And China's, in this respect, I think, are quite different. Let me just say one thing about I said that there's a range of possibilities in Asia. I actually do not like the contained China versions of it. So I don't like the honeycomb and the revived hub and spoke, because I think that the only people that are really going to sign up to this are the Japanese at this point. And I just don't think Asia needs to be polarized between a U.S.-Japan, kind of super energized U.S.-Japan alliance and then people that are more sympathetic to China, because South Korea, Australia, India, none of them are going to sign up for that that alliance of Asian democracies in the short run, and they don't want to be put in a position of having to do that. And so there, I think, actually, these broader-based, a little bit less ideological organizations, I think, for the time being, are the way to go. China attacks Taiwan, people get much more worried about it as a real near-term security threat. Then I think as we get closer to that kind of world, which does not exist right now, then I think we should think more seriously about concrete security, more ideologically based security arrangements.
It does seem like there's a general agreement that we're under-institutionalized, though there does seem to be vast disagreement on what sort of institutions we need. And just in my role as journalist, if I could bring the discussion back to the near future again. Specifically, the next president is going to deal with Iran. Is there, for those who believe in that we need more institutions, is there reason to think that some imagined institution would be more effective than we currently are in preventing Iranian nuclear weapons? Or is there reason to believe there are institutions that could help liberalize Iran away from its current direction?
One of the advocates of reform of the UN Security Council, which is, of course, the most obviously in need of rebalancing of all international institutions, the most obviously anachronistic in the way that it weights the victors of World War II and ignores the big economic powers that have since grown up. I'm intrigued to hear how a reformed UN Security Council might perform better. My instinct is that any reform of the UN Security Council is bad for the United States because it reduces its preponderance and increases the chance of its being outvoted. But I'd love to go into this issue because it seems to be the most important institution in the international system and the one which is most likely to be reformed in the next 4 or 8 years.
Okay, let's take up the UN. I wish my colleague Anne-Marie Slaughter were here because she thinks about this more than I do, but we share the view that reform of the UN is important, and so the reason why the UN we need to give it one more shot is that so much of the world measures the legitimacy of collective international action by some measure of support by the UN, particularly the Security Council. So it's a mechanism that, if it's organized well, it can be an instrument for leading states to do what needs to be done, talk about sanctions, enforcement of decisions as they relate to states like Iran. Greater support in Europe, America does, if it can get the Security Council to go along with it. You get 20 or 30% shifts in public opinion. So there's an asset there thinking specifically for the moment about the U.S., that lays there ready to be seized if it's reconfigured and used effectively. Now, reform also is necessary to, in some sense, save the UN because as time goes on, it will look more and more anachronistic. The countries of 45 still having the veto. And so it, like the UN, like the IMF, is likely to continue to look more and more underrepresentative of the underlying reality of power in the world. And so can we still have a Security Council that looks like it does today in 2040 and think that the Security Council will have weight to be used by the U.S. and other states as collective action? I think the answer is no, and so you need to bring in those states that are clearly important international actors that have to be involved in all sorts of different international actions, not just the use of force. Germany, Japan, India, Brazil, arguably South Africa. So there are different proposals, but the good news is bringing these states in. Most of the states that we would be bringing in are democracies that want to live in a world like we want to live, that we want to live in. So it's doing us a favor bringing partners into the Security Council. Now, there's a question of veto. We propose that there be weighted voting on non-resolutions, political resolutions. We don't advocate the elimination of the veto. That's where the Security Council can be abused for polemical purposes. But we do suggest some kind of equation that will end the veto. Although I would be happy with new members not getting the veto, the current members retaining the veto for a certain period of time. There are lots of different ways you might be able to find a consensus. But the basic point is that the UN, for better or worse, still has, because of its universal character, still has authority that no other institution can have. And so if we've been talking, if there's a sense of we're under-institutionalized, that the authority structures for acting collectively are not in place to deal with 21st century needs, we have to start with the UN because that's where there's the most chips left on the table that we can seize. And so we have to wade into this issue of reform. The single first step, I think, is to get China to agree to Japanese membership. And there the Japanese have to play their role. It can be done, but everything is connected. It's a Rubik's Cube. You've got to get Japan and China to do the sorts of things that I think Frank is talking about, find some way that they don't divide Asia. So everything's connected. It's a long shot. But I think if the next president is a Democrat, that president may have to, and it would be better for a Democrat than a Republican president to do this, is to put this issue on the table and say, you know, American membership in the UN really hinges on reform and threaten exit. I don't want that to happen, but I think it's going to take that kind of leverage. I don't. Bill is saying yes, yes.
He's willing to roll the dice.
That's what worries me, I hate to have Bill as my ally on this because it worries me. Maybe I'm making the wrong decision here.
Is a Democratic president or a Republican president going to threaten exit from the UN if they don't fix the Security Council, John? I mean, seriously, really, is that a real proposal?
Well, I'm saying that at some point, how do we get these blockages to become unblocked? And I'm just asking, it's an honest question, how do you do it? One answer is you can't. Another answer is that you have to be serious about it, and American presidents have not been serious about it.
Look, one way to be serious, just make an obvious point. Honestly, you guys have thought much about the UN Security Council than I have. Let's not reify particular institutions or particular names. You want to accomplish certain things through certain multilateral concerts and bring in certain great powers into closer relationships, perhaps. And there are ways to do that that might be done outside the UN or in other ways through the UN. I mean, I think it's a little bit odd to say that the UN is so central. I mean, the UN is not, you said, you made an interesting segue early on, you said the UN is really central to global legitimacy or something around the world, and then about two sentences later you said in Europe. It is central in Western Europe. It's not central in the rest of the world. It just isn't. I mean, this is an empirical question, but I do not believe, as an empirical question, the people in, well, China and Russia go without saying that they have a national interest reason for caring about the Security Council, but they are not deeply moved by UN, either General Assembly or UNSC legitimacy in terms of foreign policy. I don't believe anyone in Asia, and I don't believe, you know, Latin America cares more about, I think, their regional institutions. And Africa, in fact, turns out to care more about regional institutions, I think, and they don't really regard the UN as legitimate unless it's done through the AU. So I myself would look much more at regional ways to organize what does need to be organized. I mean, I don't think anyone argues about that in terms of greater cooperation in certain ways, instead of making it an all or nothing bet on the UN Security Council.
Very important piece. This question, we talk about legitimacy and the legitimacy deficit of American foreign policy, and we, I don't think, talk enough about the legitimacy deficit in international institutions, and this is a major problem, of course, with the UN, not just on the basis of not just because of membership anachronisms or 1945 anachronisms, but of course because of performance, peacekeeping performances, and so forth. And the greatest favor the United States ever did the UN was to do nation building and peacekeeping as badly as we have in Iraq, because it puts the whole decade of UN debacles in a whole new context. But on the specific question of the Security Council, Gareth Evans says, and I know Bob will hate this, but Gareth Evans said that the UN Security Council, now the permanent membership, is comprised of two 19th century powers, two 20th century powers, and one 21st century power. You do? Okay. Oh, okay. I thought from your paper that we were still, for the foreseeable future, we were the superpower. There were other great powers.
Oh, you mean he's seen that they're over, or they behave like 20th century power?
That we're on the decline.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, and if you want a great, I mean, here we talk about cooperation and sort of the commons and the global interest and how states will see their interests as being at stake in cooperation. I actually think the experiment with Security Council reform last year, the effort done very badly and boneheadedly, of course, by Bolton, but is a testament to the kind of residual force, anachronistic force maybe, of the most parochial interests. I mean, the way that Japan and China squared off on membership, the way that India was foiled by Pakistan, the way that Argentina foiled Brazil, it's still, you know, all politics is local. It really did come down to regional rivalries, you know, killing at least the first round of an effort to enhance global legitimacy or the legitimacy of the decision-making body. So back to Neil's question, we have a problem with this. We have a world that, and I think I disagree with Bill, amazingly, and again, I think it's anachronistic, despite the fact that the powers who make up the Security Council are not representative of global demographics, of global power, of culture, religion. It's not remotely kind of multicultural compared to where the world is now. It has this residual force where when you don't get Security Council authorization, it actually bothers people in Latin America and in Africa and so forth. That doesn't mean that regional solutions aren't the answer or the complement to this clogged body at all. It doesn't mean that. But it still has this kind of force. So I think what John's trying to do is to say, look, if we started today, we couldn't get a UN charter. We couldn't get people to agree on first principles. So we have these institutions that were set up. We have a body that's tasked with deciding whether something is a threat to peace and security. Maybe it's better in the world that we have a legitimacy-providing body than not. If we started from scratch, we won't be able to get that body without excluding China and some of these other, you know, and further polarizing the world as it is. So then the question becomes, how do you overcome this clog, because China and Russia are not playing on the security front, and they're not playing on the humanitarian front or on the commons front, and the United States isn't playing in ways that matter to them. So then Neil says, well, what about lifting the veto? And John has this sort of middle alternative. I think lifting the veto actually probably in the end is the only way that you create a body that persists with legitimately in a globalized world where everybody's watching and where the power differentials are not what they were. But there's no way, to your point, to my paper yesterday, your very good point, there's no way you clear the domestic hurdle in the United States. it obviously diminishes U.S. power in the moment, but it perhaps enhances it in the long term when you think about the fact that this body is moribund by virtue of the Chinese veto. The one little footnote on China, just because we're creating kind of doomsday scenarios about its military expansion and so forth, China in 2001 was 45th among U.N. member states in peacekeeping, and the United States back then was 15th. Today, China is 13th in terms of its contributions to UN peacekeeping, and the U.S. is 43rd, although that sort of has a lot to do with other things, I'm told. My question, it comes back to Steve Van Ever's paper, and this veto discussion, I think, just gets at it, and it gets to, again, Neil's comment yesterday. If we can all agree, we don't agree on anything. We don't agree on whether the U.S. is less safe, whether the U.S. is in decline, whether anti-Americanism harms U.S. security, whether how we weigh traditional security threats or non-state actors. We can't agree on anything. All we can agree is that, in general, more cooperation is good. And when people want to do things that are in our interest, that's good. So given that we can agree on that, I think the question going forward is, how do we get people to agree with what we think is in our interest? How do we enhance cooperation? And this is to Steve's point. What do we do about special interests? What do we do about the fact that, talk about the Taiwan lobby in the China debate, let's say engagement with China and a less competitive model is the right one. How do we overcome that? How do we deal with the Arab-Israeli, with the check on our involvement in the Arab-Israeli conflict? How do we deal with the fact that we're now forgiving debt in Africa, but we won't deal with the farm lobby? How do we deal with the chemical lobby and homeland security if we're going to enhance our resiliency when we are attacked? How are we going to actually clear the domestic hurdle? We have these dual audiences, global audience and a domestic audience, for everything we do. Let's just say it was good for cooperation to apologize for some of what's gone wrong, for torture and so forth. Let's just say it was good to enhance our cooperation in other areas in the national security domain. How would we conceivably get past the New Hampshire crowd and the domestic check on what's actually good for enhancing our cooperation and restoring our legitimacy? I mean, that's the gorilla in the room, it seems, that even if we could agree on what's right to do from a national security perspective, we really run up against the problem of democracy and the virtue of democracy.
Let's get rid of it.
Yeah.
Can I just say, as someone who's in Washington, I mean, talk about the Taiwan lobby, talk about being frozen in amber. Beijing lobby is considerably stronger. As those of us who fought a little bit against most favored nation status for China, who fought a little bit for some human rights emphasis and the foreign policy with China, whether that was right or not, the idea that people in this table, serious people, Steve used it, but are thinking, those American domestic politics, that Taiwan lobby is preventing pro-China policy.
How about
in the
Halliburton?
US?
How about missile defense? How about retailing our military to meet insurgencies and the number of vested interests who won't let us do that and who are channeling this $500 billion in directions that aren't actually conducive to meeting the threat?
The lobby called the Navy, the Air Force. I mean, right.
No. Come on. I mean, do you think that military expenditure is made on the basis of threat, of actually meeting future threat and contemporary threat? I mean, that the allocations, roughly?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's great for us to sit here. I mean, we're going in a bad direction now, but I mean, it's great for us to sit here and say we know exactly what the threat's going to be and how the military should be shaped, and only the idiots who actually spent all their life doing this are wrong about it. I mean,
I
understand
I'm
that there are lobbies. You know,
Bob and I spent a lot
of
time arguing.
I know Charles knows what to do with our military.
At this point, it's a good instance. People who agree, basically, I'd say, in the late 90s on general foreign policy issues, had real debates about where Pentagon expenditure should be, whether there should be a transformational attempt and a revolution in military affairs, which would lead you towards a certain amount of high-tech, air-powered, Navy stuff, and that was a very prominent argument, or whether we needed more ground forces. That was an honest debate among people who didn't actually have grand differences on foreign policy. So the notion that we could have a great foreign policy if only all these interest groups were there, I just think is...
No, but I just think there's a skewing. How do we restore our legitimacy and get past the fact that actually taking some of the steps that would work for a global audience can't work domestically right now, given poll data, given spin doctors, given the,
given maybe that the people are right that some of these steps wouldn't be in our national interest? I mean, do we get to put that on the table as a possibility?
No, of course, absolutely. But I mean, okay, well, how do we restore U.S. legitimacy then? Or does legitimacy not actually matter for our national security? I mean,
I assume Bob was being ironic. Look, whatever strategy, I'm wouldn't second guess, and I thought, in fact, some of what Rumsfeld was doing made sense. But you're going to come across, you're going to have constraints in whatever you don't do, and so you'll invest in stealth bombers, and you won't have people on the ground. You invest in people on the ground, and you'll decide that you're 2,000 miles away, and somehow you've got to, drop a missile someplace in, in a Belgrade window, and you won't have it. So that's part of that's life about the military, I think. And you try and get reasonable people, some of whom are within the organization and have expertise, and some who are out and bring other perspectives. And I don't. That seems to me. I think we should really ask ourselves, though, about this term democracy, which we're throwing around. I'm not sure my friends are Democrats anymore in some ways. I mean, if I read a lot of the discourse about what they think is democracy, it's people like us sitting around a table and not being disturbed by the crazies outside who get to vote. I mean, 30% in our paper we got on our doorstep today, 40% of the people thought creationism was a good thing, and a good number of it thought that they wanted candidates who believed in it. I mean, let's face it, are we really, I agree with Jim. Our standard for the international arena should be something like the rule of law. Like Fareed said, liberalism. I mean, this democracy stuff is really a genie in a bottle. Sometimes it works. It worked better in the last Algerian elections than I thought it would work. I mean, or the ones that dictated. Sometimes it obviously is going to, God knows what we'd get in Egypt with it. Let's face it, we don't, and this is what the administration is discovering. It's much too simplified a thing. I also.
Our democracy. Law in our democracy?
There are rules of procedure, but it's
can we just not focus so much on the election part of it.
Well, look, we have no other way of legitimating whatever these groups are. Then ultimately, somehow they're aggregated and they go to polls. But in terms of a foreign policy doctrine, I think it's a very troubling one. And I really do believe that a lot of us are not Democrats anymore. I mean, in around the table, my friends. No, even in terms of the United States, us is
that's not question.
I mean, I think when I listen to the conversation,
liberal academics.
Liberal academics, but also, and I'm one of them.
No, I agree with that. That's a correct characterization of a strong strand of thinking.
And I think we try and define it in terms of expertise, in terms of conversations, this great notion of this Habermasian notion that's dominated us for the last 20 years, have a nice conversation. I mean, governing is choosing, and setting policies. I just think we've put on the table, certainly is the other thing I don't really, I think the whole notion of decline has been really underlooked at in terms of what it represents and whether it's a bad thing or what it a neutral thing. I mean, anyway, I was just you asked me what I think. I'm probably closer to you on military doctrine, and less close on
I would just say, as someone who goes from sphere to sphere without it being an expert in any. There's more disagreement around this table than any comparable group of social scientists in any other sphere. That economists have much more agreement on basic things about what to do. Well, but so do sociologists, so do...
They assume more, they agree with more on assumptions.
Well, but Samantha was saying that we disagree on the future U.S. power, we disagree on the different rifts, we disagree on everything except we all agree on cooperation. But if we disagree on all the underlying issues, we don't really agree on cooperation. It just strikes me the problem is maybe not democracy, but there just is nothing even close to a consensus even among reasonably like-minded people around the table.
But don't we all agree that we need other people's help to meet transnational threats? Do we all agree? I mean, we may diminish the role, how important transnational threats.
Cooperation, because sometimes what we need, would we like them to do what we would like them to do? Yes. I'm not sure they would necessarily always do that. Cooperation is actually means that you might be giving up something, right? I mean,
right,
it's
that's
not.
The point. Yeah. How do you incentivize other people?
It would go on a case by case basis, wouldn't it?
Okay, so counterterrorism, global warming.
No, but what constituted cooperation? Frank says, how much cooperation do we do with Russia on counterterrorism if their version of counterterrorism is killing another 100,000 people in Chechnya, right? I mean, those are the kinds of things that come up, right?
Right. But, okay.
Well, I'm not sure where, I don't want to, if there's a flow to this discussion, I don't want to interrupt it, but I'm not quite sure what that is.
We're in the rapids somewhere.
I had a two-finger on the lobby question and then a different kind of point. Everyone was kind of dancing around this, but it's the lobby question is directly relevant to Security Council reform, because the primary reason that the United States would not want to give up its veto in the Security Council is because it does not want to give up the ability to veto anti-Israel resolutions. And so it's an interesting question whether if you could, I mean, absent that issue, whether you'd be willing to give up our veto in order to get rid of the Chinese veto on places like Darfur. But because I think of that, because of the Arab-Israeli issue, it's just not going to happen. So I think we're kind of stuck there. I had this broader point, which came up, I guess, in John's paper and earlier, about what it is that we are offering in terms of our influence around the world. In the past, our program has been pretty appealing, but it's been based on a combination of political democracy and free trade, basically market-based economics. And I would say that if you look at how the world has been changing in the last few years, there's one piece of that that is really missing, where we are being killed in competition with forces like Chavez, Hezbollah, Muslim Brotherhood, Ahmadinejad, and so forth, and that is on the issue of the social agenda and basically poverty more broadly. Mike Mandelbaum in the early Clinton years wrote this article in Foreign Affairs called Foreign Policy as Social Work, and he was very contemptuous of this idea that we should, you know, care about these sorts of social issues. But I think that if you look around at why people vote for that same list of people, Chavez, Hezbollah, Ahmadinejad, Muslim Brotherhood, it is not primarily over foreign policy issues. It is because these groups are all able to offer social services to poor constituents that are not served by the existing political systems. And what we've been offering these people, democracy and free markets, does not get to that constituency. And the reason that we are being killed in these races, and the reason why if you had competitive elections in Egypt, our guys wouldn't do so well, is that we just don't have anything to offer in this regard. And the reason we don't have anything to offer is, I think, domestically we've been brain dead on all of these social policy issues for the last, you know, 25, 30 years. We've not done any interesting thinking about it ourselves. And so I think that if you are worried about preserving American influence and the influence of people friendly to the United States, you've got to offer something in this regard. I thought it was actually quite interesting when Bush was in Latin America on his last visit. I thought it was actually done extremely well. He did not mention the name Hugo Chavez, and he did talk about poverty. And I think, you know, if you don't start talking in those terms, you are going to lose this competition with all these people that we don't like. And, you know, again, democracy and free markets, that's a fine agenda, but it is not not sufficient.
Before we get to John, can I ask you if you think the domestic Lou Dobbs's, Sherrod Brown's, John Edwards are related to the Hugo Chavez's, Hezbollah's of the world?
Well, we have a domestic inequality problem also, which I think, and I actually think the immigration debate is a displacement of that. I mean, somehow we can't internally argue about class issues, but, you know, we get it displaced onto dislike of foreigners. But yes, I would say if I had to broaden the overall agenda, we have got some social problems in this country that the and we're kind of stuck in this Reagan-Thatcher way of thinking about the world for the last 30 years that is not really responsive to the, some of the social changes that have occurred, the structure of our economy and the nature of our social mobility and so forth. So I think that we do have that problem at home.
To John Mill and then Stephen.
Yeah, I think we do agree on something basic, and let me try it out. It seems to me that we, but also America over the generations, has seen its interests served by supporting efforts by itself and others to build an open capitalist world system. And this is Mel Leffler's book makes this argument as the kind of core or kernel, if you will, of American grand strategy after World War II, an open, friendly, stable world order that would allow for American capitalism and the the vibrancy of the American system itself to be advantaged, but the operation of that system over time will also have effects on other states that will make them more inclined to integrate and cooperate, and the system itself improves over time. Behind that political vision of what kind of world we want and how to move in that direction is the kind of modernization assumption that there is a pathway. And Frank has, I think, I read this as the central argument Frank made. It's a modernization argument, not the recognition argument. It's the argument about there is a kind of pathway, and modernization has a pathway, that there are stages and phases, and economics and politics do have a relationship. I call it a kind of liberal historical materialism, because there is the assumption that the underlying material reality and industrial society theory makes this argument. Raymond Aron and Clark Kerr and all those 50s, Rostow and Huntington and others in a certain phase, that the world does have, there are ways in which you industrialize, and there are certain logics of building cars efficiently, for example, and whether you're a communist or a capitalist state, you have to kind of use those technologies and those logics, and that has implications for how you organize society, hierarchies, how you reward people and groups and incentivize workers, and it leads to development. So this is all an American vision, I think, and in the process there is this assumption, it may not be correct in the short term, that this system has the kind of lapping tides of capitalism does wear down authoritarianism, but not always fast enough to deal with the Irans of the world, but fast enough in the long term to suggest that it's worth betting on trying to create the structure, maintain the structure in which this opens process, not what the government does, but what society and economy does on a global scale. So what we disagree about is how much we need to actively promote it, how much America has to be at the center of it, how much you have to deal with critical cases to speed up the process. I think neoconservatives probably differ from liberals as to the long-term trajectory and how much you can let the system work on its own to get what you want. But I think that, and then in the end, the connection with democracy is the following. It's not the connection that economic development brings democracy. It's a more complicated argument. It's that economic development creates societies that when democracy comes, if it comes, it's more likely to stick. This is the Adam Jaworski argument, that they're less likely to retrogress, to fall back. So I hope we agree with that. And if we didn't before I just opened my mouth, I hope we now agree. But it seems to me that's the underlying question. Then you get to questions of institutions, use of force, and so forth. But I think that's the underlying American vision.
I'd like to move beyond the vision and see if we can inject just a little bit of specificity into the dialogue, because I think that Frank has made a very good point that it's imperative to develop some sort of social agenda, and it's imperative to try to address inequality and poverty. In fact, one of the great strengths of Charlie Mayer's paper was that the last 6 or 7 pages of that paper really focuses on the degree to which globalization has engendered inequality and passion, and the two, religious passion and fervor, and that the two are interrelated. Yet neither Charlie in his paper nor Frank in his comments have suggested to us exactly what is to be done given this issue. And the volume that we're framing is really a volume about national security after Bush, how to address the future. If there's common agreement that these are among the central issues, not necessarily the central issues, but among the central issues, there's been very little discussion really of how to deal with those issues, especially in light of the fact that some of the multilateral institutions that we so praise, like the IMF, the World Bank, have actually accentuated globalization indirectly, and of course the problems that inhere in that. So if that's the case, what do we do now to deal with this social agenda that must be addressed?
Very concrete proposal in three locales: the European Union, the United States, and Japan, and agricultural subsidies.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and that gets to, of course, Samantha's issue about lobbies, but okay, but they might be overcome.
Uh-huh. Yeah, then Charles and Neil.
I'm amazed how little, doing a little effort goes a long way. It makes people who even don't benefit from necessarily the aggregate. We're not going to uplift, give every, peasant in Bolivia half of the American income, and restore that. But the sense of gesture of responsiveness, I think really what's been going on is that people have been in these constituencies, and I don't know whether they'll all win. As goes Venezuela, so goes Bolivia. But there is a sense that the United States is not listening to this problem, I think. But this begins at home, and it's a classic, perhaps Democratic Republican division. I would be for a higher proportion of foreign aid. I'd be for some programs of essentially pushing people to sustainable agriculture, but it means also restructuring the United States so that somehow we are not letting our own people feel desperate as jobs are offshore. We won't get this agenda anywhere if this problem is also an American domestic problem and there's no effort at it. And I realize the Swedish model; these things are perhaps very limited in their effect, but. My sense is some degree of social activism in terms of defining a problem, moving us to post-industrial. The Germans are starting to revive this again, and that will create a climate of opinion at home, I would hope, that would let us allocate more effort for international affairs. This is clearly where multilateralism can. In a sense, work without the conflictuality that the Security Council has. I mean, the OECD started as a organization because we gave it money to give out, and they found that was a nice task, and it does help. So,
a few minutes from the Japanese veto to microlending, but so I'm not sure we're focused, but nonetheless, Stephen has been waiting, so let me go to him first.
I just wanted to put another issue on the table. I think meetings like this, by the way, are very useful because they help define the research agenda for, the grad students who are looking for the dissertations. And I guess I don't despair. Well, when Samantha points out we disagree on things, we should keep careful track of those disagreements and view them as things that need research down the road. And there's a range of terrific questions that have been put on the table here that need research. One more that I think everyone should be thinking about is, what should be our counterterror strategy? I think one big disagreement here is, what's the prime security threat to America? Is it terror? Yes, no. And, my view is yes. WMD terror is a very large threat. If you believe that, then what should the strategy be? And I'll just tell you, among folks who think about this question, there's no agreement at all. People are at sea. The administration doesn't have a well-worked-out strategy. The latest national security strategy document has a little sketch of what I think is a very intelligent beginning on a strategy written by Doug Feith, but it's not been fleshed out. I've written a little bit about this, and I have a couple papers in the other room for people who are interested that talk more about what the strategy should look like, how many missions should our government be capable of executing in order to defeat al-Qaeda, what should these missions look like. Our thinking as a country about how to do some of these things is very primitive. I've been thinking about the war of ideas because people have been asking me to think about that, and I think our collective thinking about how does one change the terms of debate in another society is very primitive. Our specific thinking about the task we face now, which is how do you change the terms of debate in a religion, is especially thin. We sort of know how to change a society because we did it with Germany and Japan, but how do you change the terms of debate in a religion? I think we're never going to win this war on terror unless we learn how to do that. We will face an Islamist terror threat forever if we don't find some way of changing the terms of debate in the radical wing of the Islamist wing of the Muslim world.
Yeah.
Well, now you're giving me an even bigger job. But my point is...
Now we've got to madrasas.
And I would add also failed states. What to do about them? Are they a threat? What do we do about them? I mean, to talk about them as something we're going to solve is a massive undertaking. We need some careful thinking here about, you know, how one of the papers was about this. Jim Kurth talked about it very intelligently. We should return to these issues he raised about how grave a problem is it? What should the answer be? Is it strong, nasty states? Is it somehow managing the state failure from a distance? Why are we facing all these failed states, by the way? What's this epidemic about? What's bringing about so many failed states today? A third of the states in the world are semi-failed, according to those who count today. That's a change from the past. So I think we need much more thinking about counter-terror strategy.
Okay, we've got 5 minutes. And then, well, so why don't we have Neil, Barry, and Douglas, and then I'll summarize everything that's been said in haiku form.
I want to take up the point that Mel raised. I think there's a great danger here that we misunderstand two problems. First, the social consequences of globalization, and second, the non-material origins of Islamic or Islamist radicalism. Globalization is solving the problem of inequality in many, many ways, the problem of inequality between states, but it intends to increase inequality within states. If you're worried about inequality within states, don't bother addressing it through U.S. foreign policy. It is a problem for domestic taxation. If inequality grows within a society, it can be addressed within that society through fiscal policy. It is not a proper subject for American foreign policy. The other problem I detect here is the notion that there is some connection between inequality and Islamist extremism. There's none. The perpetrators of Islamist extremism are not poor. They are not the losers. They are not the people at the bottom of the heap in Middle Eastern societies. On the contrary, think of the perpetrators of 9/11. They had not, as it were, begged their way to college in Hamburg. So I think there's a problem here. We think this is, in fact, Frank, this isn't the problem that you seem to think it is, and we shouldn't worry about it.
People that vote for these groups in those countries come from that stratum.
But their being wealthier doesn't make them less radical. Look at polls in Saudi Arabia, where people are pretty prosperous. There is absolutely no empirical correlation between inequality and radicalism of opinion. And thinking there is a completely massive red herring, which will send us in the direction of, I think, completely pointless policies.
I would take Neil's point one step further. Not only is there little evidence that globalization has increased inequality between countries, there's little evidence that it's increased it within them. Either here we're projecting U.S. experience, which is the big counterexample, onto a lot of other countries where it doesn't apply. What it's increased is insecurity, and insecurity matters a lot for everyone. And there, I think, that's guidance for what kind of social policies we ought to think about at home and we ought to encourage abroad. Healthcare reform, education reform, I think David wrote about the education link this morning. But this is not first and foremost an issue for international cooperation either, because different countries are going to solve it in entirely different ways, and the spillovers, direct spillovers, what's feasible for us is not strongly shaped by what other countries do or don't do in the same domain. Having said that, I very much agree with Charlie's point that building a constituency for foreign aid and things like that in the United States requires getting our own house in order as well.
Hey, Douglas.
I want to prove your point that actually economists agree more than maybe people around this table. I did Google actually economist jokes, and there are over 900,000 sites. But
well,
after seeing the discussion,
though.
I want to reinforce what Neil and Barry said. Social policy is great, but we've also had the World Bank for 50 years. We don't know how to do it. The experts don't know how to do it. I'm not sure Jeff Sachs has the right approach. Read Bill Easterly on foreign aid. You won't be too sanguine about what we can do in that realm. I disagree a little bit on the economic development and terrorism. I think you're probably right, but we can't lose sight of the fact that the Middle Eastern economies are not just politically repressed, they're economically repressed, and that there is an economic component to our security, and we should be thinking about ways in which we can facilitate, we can't mandate it, but facilitate economic liberalization, and I think that might have some beneficial effects.
Just to wrap up, the first sentence in John's paper is, In the 21st century, America confronts a complex array of security challenges, diffuse, shifting, and uncertain. And if the president that I talked about in the beginning saw all his advisors, I think he would find them diffuse, shifting, but certain. But not agreeing much. And my sense of this session last two is that there's a great deal of dissensus. We don't really agree on much. We don't really agree on what to talk about. And I may be ahistorical about this, but my instinct is that if a comparable group had met together in 1947 or 50, they would have been much better dressed. But they also would have agreed on a lot more. You really think that's not true?
I think that really is a historical. Okay, that would be an interesting thing to think through, but I'm not so sure there was ever more consensus. Or in 67, or in,
57? Okay, I'll withdraw the comment.
No, it's an interesting question.
Well, in any case, it strikes me if you were president, you saw all this dissensus around the table, you'd be extremely cautious about moving ahead because you wouldn't be clear on who of these conflicting voices would be right. But fortunately, Bill's speaking at lunch, and that'll solve it all. So thank you, guys.